Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the drowning of a Lake Ridge High School student. Lake County Recorder Mike Brown may receive a drastically reduced salary next year. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Gary Public Transportation Corp Director of Planning and Marketing, David Wright. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. A 14-year-old boy has died after being found unresponsive in his high school's swimming pool. Lake Ridge New Tech School's superintendent says Curtis Walton was pronounced dead early Thursday at the University of Chicago Medical Center. Dr. Sharon Johnson Shirley tells The Times that Walton was found unresponsive at the bottom of a Calumet High School pool opened to the school's football players following Wednesday's practice. Johnson Shirley says trainers tried to revive Walton, who was a freshman member of the football team. He was taken to a Munster hospital before being airlifted to Chicago. Johnson Shirley says Walton's death has devastated his family, school staff, and students, and, quote, we're just trying to make sense of what happened. The Lake County Sheriff's Department is investigating the boy's death. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The founder and CEO of Safe Haven Baby Boxes says an infant has been safely left at a new baby box in Northwest Indiana. Monica Kelsey says a baby girl was left Friday in the baby box at Hammond's Franciscan Health Hospital. The padded climate control box opened there August 7th. Kelsey says hospital staff was notified as soon as the box outside door was opened and retrieved the newborn within 90 seconds. The child has since been released from the hospital to the custody of the Indiana Department of Child Services. Kelsey says the baby's mother has contacted her organization and isn't from the Hammond area. The baby box program allows a mother to relinquish her newborn anonymously without fear of prosecution. Two have been surrendered in nearby Michigan City.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
In observance of National Child Passenger Safety Week, Franciscan Health will host free car safety seat clinics at its hospitals in Hammond and Michigan City. The clinic at Franciscan Health Hammond will be 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. Sunday, September 15th. The clinic at Franciscan Health Michigan City will be 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, September 21st. ArcelorMittal will provide free car seats installed by a certified technician while supplies last. Some qualifications are required to receive the free car seats. The National Highway Transportation Safety Administration recommends that whether you've installed a car seat or need help installing or using one, get help at a car seat inspection station near you. Children under age 1 should always ride in a rear-facing car seat, and children age 1 to 3 should remain rear-facing until they reach the top height or weight limit allowed by the seat manufacturer. Children between 4 and 7 should be in a forward-facing car seat with a harness and tether. Once the child outgrows the forward-facing seat, it's time to travel in a booster seat, but still in the back seat. Children 8 to 12 should remain in a booster seat until they are big enough to fit in a car seat properly.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Lake County Recorder will likely receive a $1 salary for fiscal year 2020 because he hasn't been showing up for work. The Lake County Council discussed the salary of Recorder Michael B. Brown during the first reading of the fiscal year 2020 budget Wednesday and agreed to a $1 salary. Councilman Dandernell says the salary won't be official until the budget is approved October 8th. Additionally, the council approved having the employees in the recorder's office subpoenaed for an October 3rd hearing for questions about the recorder's whereabouts. Charlie Brown raised questions about how often Brown attends required training for his position. In an interview with the Post-Tribune, Michael Brown said he wanted to speak with an attorney when asked when he last went into work. He was re-elected as recorder in November 2016 after first winning the seat in 2013. Michael Brown did reference meetings at the beginning of the year with the Indiana Board of Accounts, adding that he met with the information technology vendors as well. As an elected official, Michael Brown said he holds a lot of meetings outside of the office and that he's, quote, never not responded to emails or calls from staff. In May 2017, Estella Montalvo of East Chicago filed a lawsuit in federal court that alleged she was forced to leave her part-time job at the recorder's office because Michael Brown sexually harassed her. The county settled the case for $185,000 in October 2018. The settlement included no admission of guilt on the county's part. At the time, Michael Brown said that he fully cooperated with a state police investigation which found no wrongdoing at the county's own and with the county's own investigation. Former Lake County Sheriff Roy Dominguez represented Montalvo in the case. Michael Brown said he was essentially, quote, sued by his mentor, referencing close ties to Dominguez's family as, quote, revenge for not supporting him for sheriff. U.S. Steel discharged even more oil into Lake Michigan area waterways last Friday. This comes just a few weeks after an oil leak at the company and a chemical spill from ArcelorMittal. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, residents and environmentalists are hoping this won't become, quote, the new normal.
Scott Lehman is the town council president at Ogden Dunes. He says these recent spills have coated beaches in the area and polluted Lake Michigan. They've also forced Indiana American Water's treatment facility in Ogden Dunes to shut down twice. Lehman says it not only supplies water to towns in northwest Indiana, but to other Great Lakes states.
It's not just a concern for our town. It should be a concern for everybody.
Lehman worries that if these industrial companies aren't held accountable, the spills will keep happening. Until Indiana American Water knows water near Ogden Dunes is safe, it will supply its customers with water from its Gary facility. U.S. Steel says the oil has been contained and that it's investigating the source of the leak. The company and the Indiana Department of Environmental Management refuse to make anyone available for an interview. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
One of five death row prisoners set to be executed at the U.S. Penitentiary in Terre Haute is asking a judge to halt his execution. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brosher reports, Lesmond Mitchell's attorney argues racial bias may have played a role in his sentencing.
Mitchell is set to be executed December 11th. He was convicted of killing and mutilating a 63-year-old grandmother and her 9-year-old granddaughter. His attorney filed a motion requesting a stay of execution this week. The motion says Mitchell is a member of the Navajo Nation, and racial bias may have clouded the judgment of jurors who sentenced him. It says the court should halt Mitchell's execution so attorneys can look into the potential bias. The government must file its response by September 27th. Mitchell's execution is one of three scheduled for December. They will be the first executions of federal death row inmates since 2003. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brosier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Congratulations are in order for Larry Breckner and Esther Golden for their one-year anniversary of hosting the WVLP show Art on the Air. You can stream the show live every Monday at 5 p.m. as well as Friday at 11 a.m. by visiting WVLP.org.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Wednesday marked 18 years since the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. That means most high school students weren't alive when the attacks happened. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jennifer Weingard spoke to the social studies teachers of Clay High School in South Bend about how teaching the topic has changed.
For those who lived through 9/11, it's a day that will never be forgotten. Darcy King Oblenis teaches U.S. history and government at Clay.
It is a hinge of history, and you do remember where you were, what you were doing, how you felt, and how you were forced to process. And so it is innocence lost, and it's stunning, and it was an emotional impact.
And early on after 9/11, students had those feelings and memories as well. For today's high schoolers, they don't remember 9/11, but they live every day with the impact of it. They've never been through an airport without people taking off their shoes. They don't remember a time when America wasn't at war. They don't have the same expectation of privacy that older generations do. And some of them don't know what happened on September 11, 2001 at all. Janae Hartman is a social studies teacher at Clay.
Since I have the freshmen, my job is to introduce the topic. These kids were not born. So they, unless they've been introduced to it early on, they don't know the details of 9/11.
Hartman starts out with what the United States was like before that bright Tuesday morning.
We had fallen into this complacent comfort zone of no one attacks the United States, and how when something like that happens, how we have to shift our societal norms and go forward with those kinds of changes.
Then the students learn what happened that day and what has happened since, the societal changes that impact everyday life in America 18 years later. King Oblenis builds on that. She says she tries to get the kids to connect with the event. She has them interview an adult that remembers 9/11. Then the students have to write about an experience in their life that impacted them.
The confusion, the astonishment, the fear, the anger, and try to capture that in their own personal life. When in their life did they experience something that changed maybe the trajectory of their life?
Wendy Harmon teaches social studies at Clay High School. She says in her classes she tries to use 9/11 as a teaching moment for what it means to be American.
Trying to connect them with those feelings of what do we want as a nation? What do we want as a country? Who are we as Americans? So I kind of take some of the small snippets of things and then kind of relate it to current events and how it might relate to them now.
The teachers' goals are to use history to help the kids understand the impact the past has on the present and on the future. King Oblenis.
My history kids can hopefully connect emotionally. My government kids, an emotional connection, but maybe a real life connection of issues that are facing us today.
One day, it will fall on this generation of students to pass on the history and lessons of September 11th to those even further removed from the events of that bright autumn day 18 years ago. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jennifer Weingart.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The details of animal abuse and neglect cases are often grim. Pets deprived of food and water, small cages covered in feces, dogs forced to fight each other to the death. But some of those cases never see a courtroom because of how Indiana defines abuse and neglect. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports, that's starting to change as the result of new laws that took effect earlier this year.
The Morgan County Humane Society in Martinsville is bursting at the seams with adoptable animals. The dog room is full, so there are several cats and dogs housed in cages in a common area of the small shelter. Adopting these animals out to loving homes is just a small portion of the work the staff here does. The nonprofit also serves as animal control for the county. Executive Director Jennifer Londrigan says some of those cases can be hard to stomach.
Shooting is frequent of owned animals, and unfortunately, it is also not illegal to shoot your own animal.
The Animal Legal Defense Fund ranks Indiana in the top 10 nationally for its animal protection laws. But Londrigan says there's still a long way to go.
Animals have been typically in our state and nationally considered property. And so it is very difficult when you're dealing with a living being to explain to the public that your animal really doesn't have any more rights than your handbag.
That can be a real challenge when it comes to filing criminal charges for animal abuse or neglect. In some situations, Tippecanoe County Deputy Prosecutor Jennifer Gutwein says prosecutors found they didn't have a case because the horrific situations they saw didn't match the state's legal definitions.
So we had cases where we had large numbers of animals confined to a very small area, or animals that were being kept in uninhabitable conditions, and the neglect statute did not cover those situations.
Tippecanoe County started an animal advisory board a couple years ago in an effort to improve the state's animal welfare laws. The group pushed lawmakers to make changes to the definitions of animal cruelty, neglect, and torture earlier this year.
The law, beginning in July of 2019, added two sections as part of torture, including electrocution or intentionally freezing or heating an animal to death.
Another change that took effect in July means someone convicted of animal abuse cannot own, harbor, or train an animal as a condition of parole. Prosecutor Patrick Harrington says before, the court could decide whether to apply the ban.
And we had multiple cases where we had animals that were killed and we could not get a ban from having that defendant who was convicted from going back out and buying another cat or dog.
Prosecutors and law enforcement say the ban is important, not just for the safety of animals, but also people. State Senator Ron Alting says in many cases, animal abuse can be a warning sign for other criminal activity.
Statistics show from our prosecutor that, you know, if you're going to harbor an animal again, not only will you abuse it, but you also have tendencies and statistics that show that you probably got abuse within the house, too.
That's illustrated in a Lafayette case from last year. Police went to a house after someone complained about possible dead animals. Court documents say the officer found a large number of rabbits inside, with animal feces and trash throughout some areas of the home. Harrington says investigators also discovered something else.
When the animal control officer went in there, due to the training from the animal advisory board, they saw in the bathroom ceiling a hidden camera. They backed out, got a search warrant with law enforcement. Lafayette police went in there, recovered, and that person was convicted of child exploitation, child pornography, and a criminal animal abuse.
A judge sentenced Anthony Leavell to 10 years in prison for the crimes. Advocates hope this year's changes will make it easier to prevent people like that from owning and harming more animals. And they plan to keep taking their fight for stronger animal protections to the State House. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with David Wright of the Geary Transportation Corporation.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we've had David Wright with us from the Geary Public Transportation Corporation on the air on some of the recent events that have happened. Some of them were, at the time, centered around the Lake County Fair earlier this summer. But today we're talking about another project that Dave and his staff and colleagues there at GPTC are working on. And thank you first for joining us on the program today, David.
It was a pleasure to get the invite, and I am glad to be here.
Well, you mentioned at least that you start out, I guess, in our previous conversation, talked about some of the improvements that are being made in the Broadway Metro Express in particular. It's been underway for, I guess, for the service itself has been going on for, I guess, about a year and a half now. And we talked about the changes that were being made then. And I know that a lot of this is a continual planning process, and a lot of these plans, I know, and in particular with this route that you were talking about there in I guess basically running from through Maryville and then to Crown Point, deals with expansion for just rapid bus service in general here in the region. What were some of the topics that you all had brought up here, I guess, in the months previous to this next session, which is going to be coming up here on September 23rd?
Okay. Thank you for asking. Mm-hmm. Last time we talked, in addition to talking about the Lake County Fair Service, we'd mentioned that we had submitted a grant to the state for battery electric buses. That's something that I guess would be a next phase in sustainability for public transportation. We actually had an inkling at the time of our conversation before, but we actually did get approval just after that conversation, and we will be receiving an $800,000 grant as a part of the mitigation settlement for Volkswagen. So we've already signed those papers with the state of Indiana and are looking for the next step in that. That would be selecting a vendor and actually ordering the vehicles. We're going to be going to Indianapolis, as a matter of fact, in a couple of weeks to visit their shop. Indigo launched a rapid bus service just a couple of weeks ago that actually does have battery electric buses already. So
is that the route that runs from downtown or through downtown and goes north up to the collar counties?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
That's what I thought.
Right. I mean, it's been a success so far. We follow our colleagues, and what their successes are and what they're doing. So they invited us down on the 30th to go over the things that they had to go through in order to implement electric bus service on that corridor. We also wanted to thank the South Shore Clean Cities. They actually assisted us in putting together that application for Volkswagen funds, and they're actually going to be a partner in implementing the battery electric bus project with GPTC. And it's going to focus on the Broadway corridor because that's our highest our highest ridership route. Mm-hmm. So our meeting on the 23rd, it's going to be at 1:30 p.m. at the library in downtown Gary. It's going to be a focus on the partners that were part of the project in the past, stakeholders currently, and the small business community, as a matter of fact, to go over what we've done so far, not just us, but our partners in implementing the improvements on Broadway, not just in transit, but in transit type and transit-related projects, and then figure out some things we could do next.
I know that one of the topics that is going to come up as well, besides the expansion of the service there on the Broadway Metro Express line, is the other changes that the Gary Public Transportation Corporation have been making in other places as well, and including some of the other corridors. Those are changes that will come up and want to have some input on?
Yes. We're going to try to use this meeting to not just talk about the Broadway Metro Express, but also go over how we'd like to prioritize additional changes throughout the entire area. These include whether or not we should start building new bus shelters, throughout our service area. Right now, Gary and Maryville are the only locations that we have bus shelters. But we've got high ridership locations throughout the area, Gary, Maryville, and Crown Point, because we have mm-hmm. bus shelters thanks to Lake County Government at the Lake County Government Center in Crown Point. But Hammond, Highland, Munster are also ridership locations that may deserve some passenger facilities. What we'd like to do over the next few months in particular, but perhaps even over the next year, is go through a conversation and a process of prioritizing how we take public transit to the next level. Can we be identifying corridors for future rapid bus service? I mean, people have talked about Grant Street. People have talked about Indianapolis Boulevard. Should we roll out electric vehicles throughout our service area as we, phase out our older buses? Should we look into increasing frequency on the BMX itself? We've got metrics in place that will trigger the potential for going from 20-minute service to maybe 10 or 15-minute service, similar to the Red Line in Indianapolis. And also, how much these would cost, which ones are more important, and maybe starting a conversation on how to pay for these improvements.
One of the other topics I know that also will come up, and it's one of the Legacy Foundation's on the table discussions that are going to be happening here on the 23rd there at the Gary Public Library, is a question which has seemingly always come up at one time or another. But I know that you're trying to get more information together, and since you're doing the expansion plans, it is dealing with the question of accessibility.
Mm-hmm. Yes. When we started the Livable Broadway Regional Plan, which is the plan that was funded by the Indiana Department of Natural Resources and the FTA back in 2015, when we did that plan, there was a very important element of it for accessibility. When we selected the locations for our BMX stops and the types of passenger facilities at those stops, we also looked at what we call and what the industry calls universal design. Instead of retrofitting an existing bus shelter or location for those who are differently abled, what if we planned for all types of accessibility when we first put a shelter out there? We did that with the BMX shelters. We also want to do that with, and this meeting on the 23rd will start looking into that, how we improve the trip from a bus shelter to a bus shelter and apartment complexes and neighborhoods and businesses that are close to those locations. We want to eventually be able to measure how accessible the bus stops on Broadway and in other places are and how accessible the businesses are that are near those stops. Because if a person can't get to a business that's less than a block from a bus stop, they're not going to use that bus stop because that business is not one that they're going to be able to frequent. So we want to make sure that we eliminate those barriers to transit at those first and last mile points before they get on the bus and after they get on the bus, and maybe assist businesses in fixing that.
One of the things I know, and you kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier here in the conversation that is going to, I'm sure, come up here, is the future. You've mentioned some of the plans that are already out there, but I'm sure that you'd like a lot more input and this opportunity coming up with the on-the-table talk, so to speak, is a way to be able to find out more, more from not only from stakeholders but also from citizens about what they'd like to see the GPTC do in the future.
Well, in addition to the on-the-table session on the 23rd, we will be announcing very soon a series of transit talks. Mm-hmm. This was something that we began actually when we started the Broadway Metro Express because we knew that that route was making some changes people weren't used to. Bus bypass lanes, express service where the bus does not stop at every single intersection in order to increase its speed. We wanted to make sure people could one-on-one ask those questions and get an explanation. That was extremely useful back in early 2018. So we're going to be restarting that in partnership with Everybody Counts Center for Independent Living, as well as some of our other transit partners like North Township Dial-A-Ride and East Chicago Transit. These transit talks will be throughout the service area: Gary, Merrillville, Hammond, East Chicago, perhaps even Whiting and Crown Point. And that will be the venue where people can talk about what works with public transit, what doesn't work with public transit, and what the priorities are for getting us to the next level. Public transit is a quality of life infrastructure element. And even with our ridership increase and with the improvements on the Broadway corridor, Northwest Indiana still lacks, we lack far behind in terms of using public transit, making it something that people don't have to check their watches all the time for, and that will be available at all hours of the day and will be much closer to their place of residence than they are now. So we want to invite the public to help us prioritize how we can get there.
Are you finding, this has happened over time, I'm sure, and you get the requests from riders, from residents, as well as from you said the stakeholders, the people that are involved in the whole process, that they are interested in seeing something beyond just maybe an 18-hour schedule, that they'd like to see something more in the lines of a 24-hour schedule someplace? Maybe not every single route, but a lot of them?
Oh, my goodness. That's probably one of the most asked questions. Mm-hmm. Our service ends for the most part at 9 o'clock on weekdays, and some routes, you know, they're in the garage at 8 o'clock. Our service on weekends begins at 8 o'clock and ends at 6. We don't have Sunday service. People have to do things on the weekends. People have to do things later in the evening. So in not being able to afford to put service out there after 9 o'clock on weekdays and after 6 o'clock on Saturdays, and not on Sundays, means that a lot of people who need public transit or, and this is very important, just want to have that option, can't use the service. That's a funding issue. That's probably, you know, spoiler alert, going to be high on the list of priorities once we start having these transit talks. People need to have access during hours that we don't currently serve.
Do you think, too, this is going to help resolve some of the issues, the side issues, if you want to call them that, of such things as food deserts and food insecurity for residents in the area that need that extra service?
Yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, earlier this year, we worked with the Purdue Extension on a survey of our riders to see how they use public transit to solve the food desert issue. There are food deserts in Northwest Indiana, not just in the central communities, but a couple of them in the collar communities, and people use public transit to get from areas with food access issues to groceries, to farmers markets. We've partnered with the Legacy Foundation in their Lake County Eats Local program, which is a farmers market program in Gary and East Chicago this year. We know people use public transit to solve the food desert issue. We want to make sure that is not too burdensome to get there. From the Metro Center to Strachan Van Til in Maryville, for instance, mm-hmm. from the Metro Center to Fresh County Market at 25th and Grant, from downtown Hammond to the Walmart Supercenter on Indianapolis Boulevard, we know how long it takes someone to travel from one point to another. We want to lower that and also elevate the visibility of that option so people can actually use public transit to get healthy foods, and maybe in the near future, public transit can be an asset in getting healthy food resources closer to where these people live.
And we know that's what the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana would like to be able to see happen the most, along with all the other issues that we have to deal with as well. So a lot literally on the table that's going to come up in these conversations that the Legacy Foundation is sponsoring, and the one that we're talking about in particular here on the 23rd. Will you give us again the particulars about this particular talk that the GPTC is going to be involved in again?
Okay. We actually, first of all, Food Bank of Northwest Indiana is a partner in the Bahrain Metro Express. When mm-hmm. they moved their facility from one location to their Broadway location, they requested and received and helped pay for a BMX bus stop right there at 64th and Broadway. So they're a very important partner. Hopefully they'll be there at this first On the Table event. It's, again, on Monday, September 23rd. It was going to be at the Gary Public Library and Cultural Center at 5th and Adams in downtown Gary at 1:30. It will be focusing on not just reviewing what we've done and making improvements on the Broadway corridor to transit and livability, but also what we can do to continue to make those improvements. Citizens as well as stakeholders and small businesses are invited to be part of that conversation. Again, 1:30 p.m. at the Gary Public Library and Cultural Center in downtown Gary on September 23rd.
Well, David, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the issues, about how the expansion for the Gary Public Transportation Corporation is coming along, aside from our last conversation we had, but in particular what is going to definitely be talked about at this on-the-table discussion coming up here in Gary very soon. Thank you for spending time with us today to talk about it.
Thank you very much. If anyone has any other questions, they can contact us via social media at Gary Transit for Twitter as well as Facebook. Gary Transit can get you right to our desk to answer any questions about any of these issues.
That's David Wright. He is the Planning and Marketing Director for the Gary Public Transportation Corporation.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.